Blog Talk Radio.
Here to provide constructive information, excuse me, on racism, what it is, and how it works. Thank you all for tuning in to listen to the broadcast. We appreciate everyone supporting the program. Hopefully you will find it constructive. If you do not feel like you're getting constructive information on this program, please find something that will be more constructive with your time and energy. We definitely do not want to waste time. We want to do as much as we can to replace the system of racism with a system of justice as soon as possible. Again, everybody, if you're tuning into the broadcast, if you're listening at Blog Talk Radio, please join the Facebook group. All you have to do is click the link where you see the Facebook symbol on the homepage. It'll take you right to the group, and you can join. You can share information about the programs. You can see what people have said about previous programs, make recommendations for people that you would like to have on the show, all of that good stuff. You can do it right on the Facebook group, so please join that. Thank you, Back of the Bus, for putting that together. Our guest for today's program, real privileged to speak with this gentleman. He has written for Time Magazine. He has also written for the New York Times. He currently writes for the International Herald Tribune. Book we're going to be talking about today, he is the author of. The book is titled The East, the West, and Sex. Very fascinating book, thoroughly researched. I learned a lot in reading the text, and am thankful to have the opportunity to have him on the program today. Our guest, Mr. Richard Bernstein. Are you with us, Mr. Bernstein?
I'm right here.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today, sir.
My pleasure.
Outstanding. Could you share with our listeners anything that you think would be helpful so they have a better understanding of who you are and why you wrote this book?
Well, you've given a good introduction. I'm a journalist, sort of semi-retired now, but I worked for Time Magazine and the New York Times for many years abroad, including 7 years in Asia in the sort of mid-70s to mid-80s. I was based in Hong Kong, Asia. I lived in China for 3 years and have traveled extensively in just about all of the countries of Asia. And one thing that I noticed during all of those years was the sort of special attraction that Asian women had for a lot of Western men, the idea that for a lot of journalists, soldiers, businessmen, diplomats, contractors, people of all kinds living in Asia, to have a love affair with an Asian woman was sort of part of the adventure. And it was deemed very highly desirable, and a lot of men were pretty avid in their pursuit of Asian women. So I always thought that this was kind of a good topic, because it provided a kind of deeper and richer part of the long historical exchange between the East and the West. When I began to look at this historically, I saw that there was really nothing new to what I was observing, that actually it was something that went way back to the very beginnings of colonialist exploration, the various colonialist wars that were fought in Indochina and Southeast Asia. Then later, when the Americans occupied Japan, fought the Korean War, got involved in a long and tragic conflict in Vietnam, that the relationship with Asian women became both sort of more vulgar and more common than it had been, but that in a lot of ways it was sort of a repetition of the theme that had been established centuries before. And then I was after my last book, I was discussing this idea with my publisher, and we decided to go ahead. That we thought it would be a good topic for a book, and I think it is.
I agree. I think a very interesting topic, something that comes up on this program all the time, and really something I have observed in discussions on racism, sex between white people and non-white people, always seems to pop up, provokes a lot of interesting...
It's not only between white people and non-white people, it's also between black people and non-black people. I mean, it's it cuts in all sorts of directions. But you're right that for the most of the historical period, we're talking about from the 17th until the middle of the 20th century, it was mostly a matter of white men from England and France and America having sex with non-white women in Asia, North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, all over the parts of the world that were dominated by Western colonialism. And then after World War II, the phenomenon was sort of, if you want to think of it this way, kind of racially broadened, because, you know, obviously there were a large number of black American soldiers, and they, did the same thing as the white guys.
I definitely want to spend some time talking about the portion of your book that you dedicated to Vietnam, because I found that very interesting as well. Before we get deeper into the book, I always like to ask, just for clarification, people that haven't seen you or have not read your works, you are a white man, is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Okay. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy, and the definition that I use for both racism and white supremacy is a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they say is not white. Do you think that such a system exists, and do you think that is an accurate definition for that system?
That's a pretty loaded question. I guess on balance, I think that there's a lot to what you say, and certainly over the years, the centuries of colonialist expansion, the operation of the slave trade, the supremacy of white cultures in places like India, Indonesia, Southeast Asia, the sort of semi-conquest of China, that, yes, there's no question that in those eras, no question in my mind that we lived in an era of systematic racism. I guess my feeling is that there have been a lot of changes in attitudes and in behaviors over the last half century or so, and that if white people, if you think that white people are engaged in a sort of systematic and conscious effort to dominate all non-whites, I think it would come as news to many of the white people. I think it's a more complicated. I think it's a more complicated picture. I think there's a great deal of the heritage of what you're talking about, but I don't really think that it characterizes the world as we know it today.
I didn't. I want to point this out for our listeners that I didn't say anything about conscious, whether white people are conscious of this or not. And I also wanted to point out that a lot of white people, their first comment when hearing that definition, they immediately go to saying that I don't think white people are conscious. I didn't say that. All I said was that I believe we are in a system that supports and is and mandates that white people worldwide dominate non-white people. You said that you believe such a system has existed. I believe it has and continues to exist. Do you believe that such a system continues to exist at this very moment?
Well, you know, again, I guess I think that it's more complicated than that. I mean, take the United States. I mean, we are the superpower to some extent. We exercise a kind of domination in many parts of the world. We're also a multiracial society. And whether this represents the domination of white people or simply the power of a multi-ethnic, multi-racial American empire, I don't know. I mean, and in any case, I'm not really sure that a productive discussion between you and me and some of your listeners would depend on us agreeing entirely on these definitions. In any case, as a white person, I would like to think that I'm not interested in dominating or exploiting anybody on behalf of the white race. I just don't see myself in that way. Now, you might counter that, whether conscious or not, I benefit by being a white person from what's happened in the centuries past and the heritage of that continues today. And all I could say in reply to that would be that, yes, maybe that's true, but it's not a benefit that I seek or that I desire.
Okay. I did want to point out, it's you are correct. I do not think that we need to agree on everything. In fact, most of the guests that I have on the program, I've never had a guest where I've had 100% agreement on the topic of racism. I would be stunned if I ever had a guest where we agreed on absolutely every aspect of our discussion on racism. So, but I do think it's important just to get clarity about whether we feel that there is a system of white supremacy. And to note, I've had many more white people on this program than non-white people. I've only had 3 white people ever disagree with that definition and or say that they don't think we're in a system of white supremacy. One of them was the former imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Just to clarify that for folks listening in.
Yeah. Well, have no no sympathy whatsoever with the views of the Ku Klux Klan. And I'm happy to see that that's an organization that's diminished in importance as the years have gone by. And if we do still live in a system of white supremacy, I think we live in a system of ever diminishing white supremacy. You have looked at globally. One conspicuous element is the rise of China. You have very major challenges to American and European hegemony all around the world. Again, I don't think that the Chinese, and I know something about China, having studied Chinese and lived there for a number of years and following events there, I don't think that the Chinese see themselves as a group of non-white people countering white domination. But But they are, I mean, by your definition, they are. I mean, they are a major global power, and they're and always have been a non-white civilization.
Again, my conclusion, we are in a global system of white supremacy, and the individuals in so-called China, you said they are non-white. I believe that they are ultimately subject to the power of the white people who practice racism, white supremacy. But I do want to get to your book. I did want to ask, though, as we go forward talking about your book, I just want to make sure I had your permission to ask you questions about all areas of people activity, entertainment, education, labor, law, economics, religion, sex, politics, and war, before we go forward to discuss your book, The East, the West.
I mean, I'm here to talk about whatever is of interest. I mean, I like to talk about things that I know something about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the book is obviously something that I feel that I know something about, having done quite a lot of research.
For sure.
Topic,
for
you know,
sure.
In other areas, we might well go beyond the definitions of the book, but I'm certainly happy to participate in a conversation with you about anything you want to talk about.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. My co-host, she is a little younger, but she, too, has concluded that we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. She is a non-white female, and she would like also to ask questions about your book and just, you know, your views on racism. Justice, are you there?
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about your colleague.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Justice, are you there? I thought I heard her.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. I don't have any questions right now.
Okay. We'll go back and see if she has some questions. I do think this is very important going forward in the discussion, because you do point it out in your book. You are married to an Asian female, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, yes, that's right.
Okay. Your book, The East, the West, and Sex, before you even get to the table of contents, it starts off with a poem from Mr. Rudyard Kipling. He also wrote, this isn't the poem that you start the book with, but Mr. Kipling also wrote White Man's Burden. Could you share with us why you started a poem or used this particular poem from Mr. Kipling to start your book?
Because I think that the poem illustrated the kind of romantic notions that British colonialists had about Asia. I mean, that's basically the whole story. I mean, I think that his poem, Mandalay, from which that stanza is taken, sort of talks about a British guy kind of wandering about in the cold, chilly streets of London, and he once served as a colonial official in Southeast Asia, and he's thinking kind of nostalgically and longingly back to the days of the warm breezes and the glorious sunsets and of the sweeter, neater maiden, as he puts it, who he knew back there, by the banks of the Mandalay. I mean, I don't. I'm not. Kipling was a 19th century figure, very pro-colonialist figure. I think I would agree that he was a racist, like most British colonialists were. They believed in the superiority of the white race and the duty of the white race to civilize the non-white portions of the globe. There's no question about that. I didn't cite Kipling in order to honor him or to agree with him, but simply to illustrate a mentality and an attitude that existed for several hundred years and that makes up an important part of the kind of psychological background to the theme that I was talking about in the book.
I completely agree. I think you did an outstanding job in the book of showing exactly what you said earlier, that this white male fascination with Asian females. It's not anything new. This has been going on for a long time, and you present a lot of information about your book about how this has been something that's been going on for centuries. Mr. Kipling, as you said, and I've never had a white person argue with me about this. Everyone pretty much has conceded, yeah, this guy, Mr. Kipling, I'd say he's a racist, white supremacist.
Yeah, he was a creature of his time. I don't think that there, it would be unusual for me anyway in my circle of friends and people that I know to share the white man's burden attitude of Rudyard Kipling. I mean, this is an idea that went out with British colonialism, certainly by the middle of the 20th century. But he certainly had those ideas during his life, and he was very celebrated for those ideas also, it's true.
And continues to be. I thought that was very interesting because the last program we did, we had a non-white person. He ended his book with a poem by Mr. Rudyard Kipling, and he said he was aware of how Mr. Kipling felt about non-white people and the burden that white people had to civilize and take care of the heathen non-white population of the planet. But he ended his book with a different poem than Mr. Kipling did, and your book begins. So he continues to be celebrated, and in my view, part of that is because we are still in a system of white supremacy. Your book, you kick off chapter one talking about a white male who uses the title China Bounder. Could you share with our listeners this China Bounder guy and what he was doing in his practice with non-white females?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to use that. I opened the book with that episode because I wanted to show two things. I wanted to introduce the theme that we're talking about of Asia as a kind of sexual happy hunting ground for European and American men. And yes, most of them are white, I guess. Not all of them, though. And two, that in China, and I think in other Asian countries, this history has produced a certain resentment that, in a way, they feel and see the exploitation of their women as part and parcel of the overall picture of subjugation. And that that there was a kind of feminization of the East. In other words, it wasn't just the Western man and the Asian woman. It was also the sort of Western masculinity subjugating Asian femininity. That Asia was turned into a kind of submissive and available woman to satisfy the desires of the West, and that there is both individually and collectively in China an awareness of this and a certain resentment of it. So the story is that there's this guy, we don't know his name, he wrote an anonymous blog, which he identified himself as China Bounder, and he described many sexual conquests of Chinese women in Shanghai, where he was an English teacher, and his whole shtick was that it was quite easy for him to find women to share his bed, that he was very good at seducing them. They appreciated him. They saw him as more virile and more masculine than Chinese men. So that he perfectly illustrated this sense of Western male superiority. I mean, the self-image of the Western male is superior to the Asian male. And then it also illustrated, this produced a sort of explosion in China of what I call sexual nationalism, where there were lots of blogs and websites. There was a professor at a distinguished university in Shanghai who wrote a very highly circulated internet message saying, you know, that we have to find this guy and throw him out of China. He's insulted our nation. He insults our men. He insults our women. He can't be allowed to get away with this. So, you know, it illustrated the whole episode, I thought, nicely set up the rest of the book, because it brought all these themes right out into the open, and it was a very contemporary thing. I mean, I finished writing the book about a year ago, and these episodes were about a year before that. So, you know, it's a quite recent episode.
Okay. Reading this, and I could be incorrect, but China Bounder being a white person and him kind of bragging about his ability to exploit non-white females, this reeks of blatant racism, white supremacy, and particularly since you used this to start your book in showing the history of how you said, you know, British and Europeans, white people, have a long history of dominating and sexually exploiting non-white people in areas that they have conquered. This to me is really just making it very clear the white people who continue to engage in these acts of going to these areas where they're impoverished non-white females who are in tough circumstances. I can be a white person. I am the very prototype of masculinity as a white man, continuing the practice of racism, white supremacy. Do you think that is a logical view to take?
Well, I have to admit that I find that to be an interesting argument, and I agree with a lot of what you say. And definitely, in this guy's eyes, there is certainly an implicit notion of racial superiority. Again, you know, these things are kind of complicated from that standpoint. I'm trying to collect my thoughts here to find out how I really feel about this, because I want to give an honest answer. The funny thing is that a lot of these guys are there in Asia because they're genuinely curious and genuinely interested in Asia and in the Asian cultures, and they like them, and they admire them. And they're living in a country, China now, which has stood up, which is very proud, which is gaining in power. I mean, they certainly live under circumstances of, you know, political and social control. They don't defy Chinese authority, nor would they get away with it if they tried to. And I don't, again, it's the difference between conscious racism and unconscious racism, if it is even racism. I didn't see it so much in terms of white domination. I think that white domination is a sort of incidental element to the fact of colonial domination. I mean, the question is there some truth to the idea of the China Bounder, that the Western man does have a certain advantage in Asia or in China? And I think, and this is where, you know, I get into some trouble with some of my women friends, including some of my Chinese women friends, I think that they do. It may not be for the reasons that they suppose. I think it's because, and I discussed this in the book. In fact, I interviewed a half a dozen Chinese women who have or had Western boyfriends or husbands. My wife is obviously such a woman. And I asked them whether it's true that a certain social class of Chinese women find it interesting or desirable to have a relationship with a Western man, and all of them said yes, they did think so. Why? Partially, it's because, and it's just economic. It'd be silly not to understand that aspect of it. Western men have money. They go to China. They're business people. They're journalists. They're diplomats. They have nice apartments. They have cars. They lead a kind of flashy lifestyle. They also can offer Chinese women visas and green cards and stuff like that, so that they can get out of China and come to live in America or England or Germany or another Western country.
I did want to point out really quick. I just wanted to point out really quick what you just described. That sounds very much like white supremacy, where a white person, because of the system of white supremacy, they have more resources. You said economics, going right to the core of it. The system of white supremacy produces a wealth of greater resources for white people worldwide.
Well,
as a result,
call it the system of white supremacy. I'll call it just the heritage of Western prosperity and Western domination of the world for most of the last 500 years. I just don't want to look at absolutely. You can look at everything through the prism of white supremacy if you want, and that's your right, and I respect that, and it's your view. I gather that you are not a white man.
Oh, no, sir. I'm a non-white person.
Yeah. I don't tend to look at everything through that particular prism. Now, you might say that that's simply because I'm a white guy, and I wouldn't understand. I don't get it. I feel that, you're... By insisting on seeing everything as a manifestation of white supremacy, I think you kind of lose out on some of the complexity of the world and the fact that the world does change over time.
But I want to get back, because I don't want to lose this. What you just said was mostly white people are able to go to these areas with predominantly non-white people, and a core part of the reason white men are able to have access to these non-white females is economics. And I'm saying, unless I am incorrect, please correct me, the system of white supremacy, that's what I'm saying, and you said it's the legacy of Western domination, produces a great deal of wealth, a great disparity in wealth between resources, period, between white people and non-white people. So for the non-white person, hey, sure, I want to be with a white person. This person can get me a visa. This person can get me out of this decrepit area. We can go to America. We can go to France. We can go to Germany. I can get a better job. I can get a better house. This would be great for me. This would greatly improve my quality of life. And I'm saying exactly what you're saying. I'm just using the term the system of white supremacy, because I feel that is much more accurate than saying the legacy of Western domination. We're talking about the system of white supremacy, the exact thing that Mr. Rudyard Kipling celebrated in his poem, White Man's Burden.
Well, okay. In one respect, I'll even go farther than you in this, and that is Asians, I think, are in a lot of ways even more racist than white Americans are, and that a black man in Asia would not have some of the advantages that a white guy has. I mean, more difficult, much less socially acceptable for a Chinese woman to end up with a black man than with a white man. And so some of these racist attitudes that originated in the West and that were perpetuated during the period of colonialism have been inscribed in the Asian mentality. And I think in a lot of ways overtly, you'd find a lot more racism among Asians than you would among white people. I mean, certainly they're much more comfortable about it than white people are. It's a pretty rare white person in America today who would admit to being a racist.
I've had tons of them come on my show and admit it. It's not that uncommon for me. I have it happen all the time. It's not even...
Oh, it's very uncommon for me in my circle. I mean, I would never... to be a racist is in among the people that I know is to believe that the earth is flat. I mean, it's just unacceptable in my liberal journalistic circle living in New York. I mean, I live in Brooklyn, one of the most racially diverse parts of the world. I mean, we want to get along with each other in Brooklyn. We don't want to be racists here.
I don't live in New York. I'm in Washington State, but I'm mildly familiar with New York, and it seems that they have a lot of incidents of racism, white supremacy pop up frequently. I did want to check. Justice, did you have some questions you would like to ask our guest, Mr. Bernstein?
Do you talk about white supremacy to your wife?
Do I talk about white supremacy to my wife?
Yes.
No.
Yes or no?
I said no, I don't.
Okay. And how does white supremacy mistreat non-white people indirectly and directly?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing. There's a lot of background noise, and I'm not hearing you perfectly. Could you ask me that again?
Lavar. Gus. I think it's coming, going over where you're at.
Can you hear? Is it okay now?
No, it's not great. I mean, Justice is coming across a little. There's some kind of shattering sound in her voice, and I'm not getting it very well. She's kind of breaking up. Maybe you could repeat the question for me, Gus.
I did hear the question. She asked, "How are non-white people mistreated because of racism, white supremacy, directly and or indirectly?"
Oh dear. I mean, this is a question that's, you know, way apart from my area of expertise or what I wrote about in the book. I mean, this is sort of a general question. You know more about that, and I imagine Justice knows more about that than I do. I mean, I can tell you that in Asia today, it's completely off limits. I mean, it's absolutely forbidden to talk about. For white people to, you know, even hint in the slightest way about any belief in white supremacy, or to mistreat people at all, certainly on the basis of race, and I've never experienced it. I've never seen it. I just don't know what to say in response to the question, because, you know, again, it's not that I think it's a bad question. It's a good question, but it's just not a question that I really have any particular knowledge about.
Okay, thank you. That's all for now.
You know, as if I could, I wanted to continue on this theme of white men and Asian women.
Oh, I have a lot of questions there.
I just respond to one thing that you said?
Sure.
Because you were, I talked about the economic advantage, and you picked up on that, and you're absolutely right to do that, and I don't disagree. But, you know, something that's happened in China in the last 20 years is kind of interesting in this regard, and that is that there are an awful lot of Chinese guys who have made an awful lot of money. There are millions of wealthy Chinese now. When I first lived in China in the late 70s, early 80s, that was decidedly not the case. The only way to have the lifestyle of a well-off person was to be a senior official in the government or in the Communist Party. And then you had a limousine put at your disposal. You had special housing. You had special film studios to go to. You had special bookstores. Your kids were sent to special schools. You could travel abroad. You could go to the state tailor where they would make nice clothes for you. It was all a matter of power in a very dictatorial society. And, you know, 99.99% of the population didn't participate in that and were very, very poor. But economic development over the last quarter of a century has completely changed China in that regard. You know, there are many, many Chinese now who live at, you know, Western European and American standards of living. In fact, I like to joke about how there are these kind of knockoff discount shopping centers in China where you can buy, you know, it looks like, you know, Ralph Lauren shirt or something like that for, you know, $5. It's a knockoff. And you know, it's only the Western tourists who go to those places. Then there are these shopping centers where you've got all of the, you know, global luxury brands, you know, Gucci and Armani and Cartier and what have you. And it's the, you know, it's the local rich Chinese who are going to those places and paying the full price for luxury goods. So, you know, if you're a Chinese woman and you're interested in, and you're a bit of a gold digger, you know, you can get what you want from a Chinese man just as easily as you can from a Western man right now. So I think that in recent years there's been something new has been added, and that is it's kind of for a Chinese woman there's a bit of an escape in forming a relationship with a Western man. I think that they can sort of escape what they experience as the conservative limitations of the Chinese culture. They think that Western men are a little more open-minded about women having careers, that they don't confine their wives to the home and to raising the children. I think they think that Western men are less likely to have mistresses, whereas Chinese men, it's part of the culture, what I call in the culture of the harem, where Chinese men, as soon as they have money, it's practically axiomatic that as soon as a Chinese guy has money, he'll, you know, try to set himself up with a concubine. Western men have mistresses too, of course, but the Chinese women think that they're less likely to do that than Chinese men. So there are other reasons besides the purely economic one for this sort of special mutual attraction between Chinese men and between Chinese women and Western men. And it's also one of the reasons why I think the China bounder aroused such a kind of fury among the Chinese men, because they don't understand, you know, why should Western men have any advantage over them? They have the money. You know, they can, you know, they dress well, they have cars, they have apartments. There's no, you know, they're physically perfectly just as capable as Western men. So what is it about these Chinese girls? What are they after? And I think that you know, and you could read. I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, this is not my own. This is not my fantasy. I mean, I read dozens and dozens of blog comments by Chinese men raising these questions, feeling angry at the Chinese women for allowing themselves to be seduced by people like the China Bounder.
For sure. I do want to get to some specific aspects of your book, because I had a lot of questions that I wanted to flush out from your book, and hopefully people will take an interest and pick up a copy of The East, the West, and Sex by Mr. Richard Bernstein. You talk in your book about in the what you call history of colonialism and Western domination, what I'm saying is the system of white supremacy. There is a legacy of white people really being attracted to non-white females, particularly in seeing non-white females as being subservient and willing to sacrifice themselves for white men. And you even went beyond the so-called East in your book, and you talked about this same theme plays out with Pocahontas and John Smith. You even later on in the book talked about a Vietnamese female who, to demonstrate her love and affection for her white sexual partner, she chopped off one of her fingers. This plays out in Madame Butterfly. This plays out in Ludovico's Travels. You list tons of examples to illustrate that. Could you kind of talk about that aspect with our listeners?
Yeah. Sure. Well, you're right. I mean, there are lots of illustrations, and there are lots of stories that, you know, make people, you know, by today's standards, very uncomfortable, and they made me very uncomfortable. But I, you know, I mean, I wrote the book in order to talk about the world as it was and as it is, not the way I wished it would be. And this is definitely a part of it. There was a sort of, there was a certain reciprocity. I mean, on the one hand, for the Western man, the Asian woman or the African woman there was something very exciting about it. There was the excitement of the exotic and the different. There's a kind of, you know, I think it's summed up in the phrase that was used to describe Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson's slave mistress, Dusky Sally, a kind of notion of some sort of superior sensuality on the part of the Asian woman, or at least not only Asian, you know, African women and so forth. I mean, there's, I talk in the book about Richard Burton, the British explorer, and his feelings about the sort of superior sexuality of he was speaking of both of African women and of Indian women. And he translated the Kama Sutra, the great Indian sex manual, because he thought that the British, who were very puritanical and uptight in matters of sex during the Victorian era, needed to learn something from the Indian attitude, the more open Indian attitude. There was even, I have a quote from the Anglican Bishop of Calcutta. I mean, the Anglican Bishop of all people, his name was Reginald Heber, H-E-B-E-R. And he admitted, this is in the first half of the 19th century, that he had difficulty keeping his eyes off of the local Bengali women that he saw bathing in the river at dawn, confessing that, and this is a quote from him, the deep bronze tint was more naturally agreeable to the human eyes than the fair skins of Europe. So, it's a very paradoxical thing, because on the one hand, I think that it does echo of the slave period in American history, where on the one hand the colonized peoples are seen as inferior, and on the other hand they're seen as the women in particular are seen as extremely desirable, more desirable in a lot of ways than white women.
I picked up on that frequently in your book. You were talking about Richard Burton. You just, you know, read the comment about how the non-white female, they were just seen as being more sensual, and oh, they're way above and beyond the white woman in Europe, and they're not as argumentative and just much better able to please a man. Found that very interesting, and particularly as you noted the contradiction in non-white people collectively being referenced as heathens, and they're uncivilized, and you note that contradiction a lot in your book in talking about how the white people who went out to practice what you call colonialism, what I say is the system of white supremacy, how they said they were doing this in the name of civilizing these people and spreading the gospel of Christianity. And a major theme of this is sexual exploitation of not just the non-white females in these areas, but non-white males, non-white children. You spend a great deal of time talking about pedophilia that went on as well. I was really hoping you could talk about, I know you talked about several people, but I felt Mr. Henry de Montholant, I felt that was a really interesting story. If you could share that with our listeners.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I've been thinking about that in particular lately in light of the news. You know, we have two stories going on right now. There's the arrest of Roman Polanski for having had sex with a 13-year-old girl all those years ago, and then there was the reaction in Europe, sort of angry that he was arrested, and this sort of dismissal of the crime that he admitted to committing. And one of the people that was most dismissive or most outspoken in his defense of Polanski was the French Minister of Culture, a guy named Daniel Mitterrand, who was the nephew of the Mitterrand who was once the president of France. And I knew him a little bit, by the way, because I served as a New York Times correspondent in Paris. After I left China, I was in Paris from 1984 to 1988. And he was already a prominent figure there. So I didn't know him personally, but I'd see him on TV, and I knew him as a very prominent sort of cultural figure. Mm-hmm. And he, in 2005, wrote a memoir that was pretty much ignored at the time, but in which he admitted that he paid for sex with boys in Southeast Asia.
Wow.
And wow. So now, after his defense of Polanski, his political opponents have been making hay out of his admission that he paid to have sex with boys. Now, in the meantime, he's come out and said that he didn't mean underage boys. That yes, he did pay to have sex in Southeast Asia, but that the boys that he had sex with were his own age. I guess I'm a little bit skeptical of that, because there's no question that there's a trade in pederasty and pedophilia in Southeast Asia. These are societies that have a lot of poverty, and there's a lot less supervision of sexual life.
Do you think all this is a result of what you call colonialism? What I'm saying is the system of white supremacy.
I think this is just a question of wealth and poverty.
You don't think that wealth and poverty is at all related to colonialism, white supremacy?
I know that's how you look at it. And again, I don't want to argue. I think that one of the reasons why white people have money is because they exercised domination of the world for several centuries, and one of the elements in that domination was racist. A lot of money was made in the slave trade itself, and, the slave trade by definition was racist. So I agree with you in that sense, but again, it isn't an ongoing, explicit manifestation of white supremacy. These practices go on among Asians also, and everything that white men are able to do in Asia, Asian men who have money are able to do also. And it's not, and they do.
Well, wait a minute, because I don't think that's an accurate comparison. I know, and you talk about in your book, I want to be accurate, you do talk about in your book how a lot of the prostitution and go-go bars and things, that's open to a lot of the non-white people who are in these areas, and they do a lot of this stuff and have done a lot of this stuff for centuries. This is not anything new. The white people didn't exactly bring practices that were not already going on in these areas. But what I do think is the proper comparison, and you point this out in your book, you do not see non-white people from Thailand or Vietnam or China coming to America and doing this. It would be unheard of for a Chinese diplomat to be coming to America and participating in pedophilia with young white boys. And you point that out consistently in your book, that for centuries, it would be unthinkable to imagine non-white people going to white areas and doing what white people do when they go to non-white areas. I think that is the accurate comparison. And the
Whoops, are you there? Hello? Hello? Hmm. Hello.
Okay, we are having Mr. Bernstein, are you
there?
Yeah,
I'm back with you. I don't know. Suddenly the line seemed to have gone dead, and
I suspect white people are not pleased with this program. I have never had this much interference. I have been disconnected myself 3 times. Thank you for calling back in. Please, I would like you to go ahead and finish your statement.
Yeah, well, you were talking about how it would be unthinkable for all of us to go in the other direction, and yes, you're absolutely right, and I appreciate how carefully you read the book. I guess I would attribute it to a somewhat different reason. It happens that colonialism went in the direction that it did go in, and that, but there was another element also, which is very important as a theme in my book, and that is that I think that what Western men found when they got to Asia was a very different sexual culture than the one that existed back home. And to a great extent, I think that also is a factor. I mean, as I say in the chapter on China, let's say a Chinese guy came over from China to teach Chinese to American university students, and then he wrote, and he slept with a bunch of them. And then he wrote an internet account about how easy it was for him to seduce white girls in America. Would he have become the subject for a kind of national debate about the humiliation of the entire nation because of this guy's comments about sleeping with white girls? I think not. I think, you know, it might have attracted a, you know, momentary attention on the part of some people, and then everybody would have just said, okay, you know, who gives a who cares? I mean, and I think because it didn't go in the other direction, we don't have the kind of resentment that that the Asians do. But also, why did it go in that in the other direction? Because Asia. And I'm talking about this very, very broad swath of territory of many different cultures and many different peoples, very different from each other. And yet most of them had one thing in common, certainly from Turkey through the Middle East, India, Southeast Asia, China, Japan. They all had the culture of the harem. These were societies in which it was acceptable, polygamy was acceptable, multiple sexual partners were seen as natural, as inscribed in the natural order of things. Whereas in the West, in the Christian West, we tended to see sex as sinful, certainly sex outside of marriage, adultery, as deeply sinful, as absolutely forbidden. It took place on a very widespread basis and still does, but it's not accepted formally. It's not accepted by legally, it's not accepted morally, it's certainly not accepted religiously in the West. But in Asia, to a great extent, it is accepted. The man of wealth and power was expected to have women besides his wife. And when Western men went to Asia, they became these men of wealth and power, and they set up their own harems. And that was the condition, the culture of the harem, that allowed this to take place on such a wide scale. That's why it's important when I say in the book that the Western men didn't do anything that the Asian men didn't do. They simply grafted themselves onto a society. They kind of went native in a way. I mean, they grafted themselves onto a society that gave men a tremendous sexual advantage. extremely patriarchal, very offensive to women. I mean, women's sexuality was tightly controlled at both ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, there were women who were forced to have sex because they were drawn into the harem. And on the other hand, the daughters and the wives of, you know, quote unquote respectable people were forbidden from having sex except, you know, with the one man that they were given to for that purpose. So, you know, the Western culture of Christianity is much more respectful of women than the Asian culture was. Or was much more respectful of women than the Asian culture was, but the Asian culture certainly allowed these kinds of opportunities, and they still did. I mean, you mentioned Henri de Monterlan, the French writer that I have what I call an interlude about. There are chapters in the book, and then there are these sort of shorter passages that usually talk about a personal anecdote that kind of illustrates the broader theme. And Monterlan is the subject of, I think it's the longest interlude in the book. He was a French writer who lived in Algeria in the early, late 20s and early 30s. And he wrote a book called The Rose of the Desert, which is about a French soldier that has an affair with a 14-year-old Arab girl. And what Monterlan was doing in that book was exposing what he regarded as the dirty little secret of colonialism. Here, you know, the French people back home thought that their soldiers were leaving, you know, these lives of great difficulty and, of hardship. And in fact, what they were really doing was having a sort of fun that would be forbidden back home. But it turns out that even though Monterlan regarded himself as an anti-colonialist, he was doing the same thing, except not with girls, but with boys. And for a long time, he was a very honored writer in France. He's not that well known in the U.S. Or in the Anglo-American world, but he's very well known in France. He was a member of the French Academy. He got all of the honors that a French writer can have. He's read in high schools and college curriculums of French literature. Very, very famous in France. He's up there with Camus and Sartre and Gide as, you know, kind of in the pantheon of great French writers. Only after his death, somebody who knew him well and who was a fellow pederast, a guy named Roger Perfit, wrote an expose of him, kind of outed him. And we found out, the French world found out that that Monterlan was an avid pursuer of what would have been in France underage boys. But the fact is that they were very readily and easily available in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It was something both economic and cultural there, and he took full advantage of it, and so did many other European men. Gide himself was. Monterlan kept it a deep, dark secret all of his life. He was terrified that somebody might find out about this. He wanted to have a public image of irreproachable respectability, when in fact he was very far from respectable. But he kept it a secret. Gide, on the other hand, somewhat older than Monterlan, actually, wrote very openly about his sexual awakening to the pleasures of sex with young boys. And in Algeria, and I refer to some of these stories in the book. There's also he and Oscar Wilde knew each other on trips to North Africa and compared notes on their sexual escapades. There are also some memoirs of this kind of thing among British colonialists. Yes, pederasty is definitely a theme, and it continues to be, as we see from the example of this French guy.
Yes, sir.
It's having sex, paying for sex with boys. That goes on. It's now it's illegal in these parts of the world, and actually, I don't know a great deal about this, but I do know that in Thailand there are any number of Western men who are in prison because they've been caught soliciting or having sex with underage girls and boys with children. And yet, certainly, it's a lot easier to do there, I guess, than it is back home.
In my view, it is easier to do there because of the system of white supremacy, and these areas are predominantly non-white. Much easier for white people to go amongst.
Entirely non-white, yeah.
Yeah. I did want to point out, I wanted to see if Justice had some questions, but I did want to pick out particular passages from your book, which I think pretty much evidence what I'm saying here. This is blatant white supremacy, and I don't think it is, you said that the white people who go to these areas or who went to these areas during so-called colonialism, that they, your term was going native. I don't think it's exactly going native. I think it is exploiting non-white people, and you say in your book on page 107, this must never be forgotten. Much of the world of sexual opportunity presented by the East has always been and still is based on exploitation and injustice. I wholeheartedly agree. You also, at a different point in your book, this is on page 122, where you were talking about, this is in so-called India, this is actually in the chapter titled Colonialism and Sex, where you said that Burke termed his promotion of the literal rape of Indian women. I want to make sure I read the whole sentence so people get a clear understanding of what you said. In the late 18th century, the political philosopher Edmund Burke sponsored an effort to have the colonial governor of Bengal, Warren Hastings, removed from the office because of what Burke termed his promotion of literal rape of Indian women. I don't think it was quite white people just going and participating in what the non-white locals were doing. I think the white people went to an area, conquered non-white people practicing what you call colonialism, what I'm saying is the system of white supremacy, and after they conquered these people, totally exploited them in every way, and at the core of that, sexual exploitation of not just females, as you mentioned, young boys, young girls, even males. There was a lot of homosexual activity that went on in this as well, that you put out in your book to some degree. Justice, if you're there, do you have any questions that you would like to ask our guests?
Okay. Not right now. Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to ask you if you could clarify. This is also from your book. I thought this was just fascinating. If you could explain this, I would be very grateful. You said on page 134, the ease of sexual opportunities made it far easier than it would otherwise have been to maintain the large military and bureaucratic establishments needed to govern and control the colonized territories. Why do you think that's true, that having sexual intercourse with the conquered non-white people would make it easier for the so-called colonizers, I would say white supremacists, to maintain control?
For a very simple reason, because it made it easier and more attractive for soldiers and colonial officials to go to those places and to have lives that were tolerable to them. The administration of the British Empire required tens of thousands of soldiers and civil servants, governors, accountants, officers, enlisted men, planters, people of all, clerks, bankers, traders, shipping executives, shipping workers. I mean, it required a whole kind of large-scale, parallel bureaucracy. And it was, to a great extent, in a lot of these parts of the world, life was kind of boring, out in some outpost in the Punjab in northern India, there was no local pub to go to, there were no dance halls, there was no theater, There weren't that many Europeans around to socialize with. Especially for soldiers, life could be, you know, pretty boring in the barracks. And so, one of the few things that these civil servants and soldiers had was the sexual excitement of living in that part of the world. And the British Empire created a large system of brothels in which they corralled thousands of Indian girls and women to serve in brothels. They did it supposedly because there was a lot of what they euphemistically call fraternization going on anyway, and because it was unsupervised and the women weren't medically checked, there was a big problem of venereal disease, gonorrhea and syphilis specifically, and it was part of an effort to get the diseases under control that the British imperial authorities set up brothels in which there would be, you know, the girls would be registered and then they would be examined every week, and if they got sick they would have to be sent to a hospital and stay in the hospital for a certain amount of time as a way of controlling the spread of venereal disease. So that's why the sexual opportunities made colonialism somewhat easier.
Okay. That very clear for me, so I just want to make sure I'm understanding. In order to get white people to come and help maintain and expand colonialism, what I'm saying is the system of white supremacy, it was a great enticement, a great motivator to say, hey, if you come here, you'll have easy opportunities for sex. Would that be correct?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to make sure we got to Vietnam because you spent a lot of time talking about that, and I found that just incredible. You said that the sexual exploits in Vietnam during the Vietnam War was uncomparable to anything that happened previously with white people and non-white people in your book, and you even had statistics. I believe, if I'm correct, you said that one-third of the troops U.S. troops that went and participated in Vietnam contracted a sexual disease of some sort. Can you talk about what exactly went on in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. There was actually a debate about that. And by the way, let me, you know, just, I kind of want to make it clear. I mean, we do have a difference of opinion here about exactly what this illustrates, and I find it, you know, very interesting. Again, I'm flattered and very pleased that you read the book with such care and with such attention. Really, there aren't very many people that I've had conversations with who have taken the time and made the effort to read the book thoroughly and to underline it and to isolate certain passages. On that, and I think that's great, and I'm grateful to you. You've also looked at the experience from your own perspective, and your perspective is different from mine. So, as you know, you see everything in it as an illustration of the system of white supremacy. I don't. And similarly in Vietnam, I certainly don't in Vietnam, because a very large number of the participants in the sexual life of Vietnam were blacks. I mean, you know very well that a lot of African-American soldiers served in Vietnam. And you know, they did the same thing that the non-African Americans did. They went to the bars and clubs. They went to the go-go bars. They had local girlfriends. They impregnated them. They had children by them. In most instances, they left them behind, or they don't even know that they had children by them. So I mean, this was something that the Americans did in large-scale fashion. White Americans and non-white Americans alike. Now, I don't know, you might want to see this as part of the system of white racism and white supremacy. I mean, I don't. I just see it as men, you know, of all sorts behaving like men do when they have these opportunities put in front of them. And they were living in a country where those opportunities existed on a large scale. there was a debate in the 60s about whether, Senator Fulbright, William Fulbright of Arkansas, who was, as you remember, a big opponent of the war. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the war very well. I was in college at the time of the war, and I knew about the anti-war movement. And because I was studying Chinese and I was interested in Asia, I was very attentive to the arguments on all sides of this, and I followed events quite closely even back then. And I remember Fulbright being a very outspoken and very articulate opponent of the war. And one of the arguments that he made, not the major argument, but one of the arguments, a little bit like Edmund Burke, you just referred to Edmund Burke and his suit against Warren Hastings in Bengal, Fulbright also talked, he didn't use the term the literal rape of Vietnamese women, but that's what he meant. He felt that Americans were prostituting Vietnam, and that the presence of so many Americans, not just soldiers, but diplomats, journalists, everybody got into this. Their presence was producing large areas of Saigon were kind of wall to wall brothel, and thousands of Vietnamese were going into prostitution because there was all that money around, and they could make money by doing that. And it was immoral, and it was demoralizing and debilitating and bad. And so there was a debate about whether this was really true or not. And I remember Time magazine, which defended the war, had an article in which they claimed that it was not, that this has always happened in war, and Vietnam is no different than any other. And that's why I cited the statistics on venereal disease, was to show that the Time magazine was wrong and William Fulbright was right, and that there was much, much more sex during the Vietnam War than there had been in any other conflict that the United States had ever been engaged in. Even, I want to stress, it was at all levels. I didn't only talk to former GIs. I interviewed maybe 25 people about this, not just former GIs, but, State Department officials, businessmen, journalists, contractors, officers, generals and privates. Everybody there were exceptions, but it was a very, very common thing. It was sort of seen as kind of an ordinary part of life. You would spend your days doing whatever your job was, and in the evening, you would go up to some place where you could meet a girl and have sex with her.
Wow.
There were a lot of women who were sort of kept by Americans. They were given apartments. They had kind of steady girlfriends, and it wasn't only a lot of again, I use this word advisedly, respectable middle class and upper and higher class Vietnamese women also kind of got caught up in the excitement of having a Western boyfriend. There's a wonderful book that I didn't write, but that I read and that I cite in my book, called Once Upon a Distant War, by a guy named William Prochnow, who talks about the early group of American reporters that were in Vietnam, sort of in the period around 62 to 64. The most famous of them was David Halberstam. But there was a group of about a dozen of them during those early days in the war. And he talks about how when Halberstam arrived in Vietnam in 62, or late 61, it happened that he arrived on the night that there was a going-away party for one of the foreign photographers. And he arrived at the party to find every single one of the journalists, I mean, the male journalist, was accompanied by some, quite beautiful Vietnamese woman. Some of them married them. Malcolm Brown, legendary figure among journalists, won the Pulitzer Prize in Vietnam. Actually, fell in love with a woman who worked in the press department of the South Vietnamese government. She had to quit her job in order to continue going out with him. And they got married. They're married to this day. They live in New York. Now they're kind of an old couple. They've been married now for close to 50 years. So it wasn't all just a matter of prostitution and kind of exploitation. There were a lot of real relationships, enduring, loving relationships were formed in that, at that time also.
I did want to highlight this. And again, you are a white man. I am a non-white male, so we definitely are going to have a different viewpoint, which is fine. We're just sharing our views. But I did want to point out, you said in your book on page 12 that there would appear to be a complicated mixture of image and experience at play here in examining sexual relationships between non-white people and white people in your book. But almost everything in this picture relates to the experience of colonial power. And I would just insert, instead of colonial power, the system of white supremacy. I wholeheartedly agree, and I see that at play in Vietnam as well. You even talked about, and this relates beautifully to what you said about how sexual intercourse can be a great motivator for getting white people to participate in so-called colonialism. You talked to one of the former soldiers that you talked to who participated in the Vietnam War. He said he did 3 tours of duty, and he said it would not be an exaggeration to say that he went back 3 times because of the food and the sex.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there were plenty of guys like that.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, again, you know, you want to see it all. I mean, from your standpoint, the entire colonial initiative was an effort, was motivated primarily by the white person, the white culture's desire to establish a kind of racial supremacy in the world, and I don't agree with that. I mean, it happens that they were white, and they did establish supremacy in the world, but they didn't do it because they were interested in subjugating non-white peoples. As an end in itself. I mean, their end was national power, was money, was national glory. It was to enrich themselves. It was to compete with the other powers, so the French and the Germans and the British, and then later the Americans competed with each other for global supremacy and global power. The racial element in all of this is really incidental. I mean, you want to put it as the primary motivating factor, and that's where I don't agree with you. I can understand why you see that, because the end result certainly looks a lot like, you know, the white people are in power, and so it was a system of white racial domination. But that wasn't the racial domination wasn't the motive of it.
Well, I could be incorrect. I do want to point out again, your book begins before you even get to the table of contents with Mr. Rudyard Kipling, who was very explicit in saying, in The White Man's Burden, what we're doing here is conquering these heathen, savage, non-white people. You yourself said he's a racist. You began your book with him, even though it was not the poem White Man's Burden.
Right. It wasn't the poem White Man's Burden, and it was a poem that, you know, illustrated his sense of the romance of these, that there was a quality of beauty and sound, kind of a sensual quality, a quality of sensualism and charm that he remembered all of his life, even though, I mean, he actually lived in India. He was born there, and then he went back to the home country for his education, and then he returned to India. He lived in Lahore, which is now one of the major cities of Pakistan, for about 6 years as a journalist, in which he wrote most of the stories and poems that he's famous for. Then he went home to England. He never lived in India again. He lived back home for the rest of his life. He got involved in a lot of other things besides writing about India. But even Kipling, and it's true, he used that expression, the white man's burden, and that's, you know, a kind of emblem of, became sort of an emblem of Kipling, and he saw it, yes, that the white race has a sort of responsibility to bring the blessings of civilization to the non-white peoples. He did see it that way. I agree with you, but I don't think that colonialism itself was primarily an effort to see to the supremacy of white people. The British colonialists are not the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. their motive.
I didn't say they were.
You know, when you talk about how, you know, that their motive was, I mean, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan's motive is to maintain the dominance of white people. He believes in the superiority of white people. In this day and age, there are people who actually still believe in that nonsense. But, I mean, the British colonial system didn't particularly believe in it. It was a sort of an understated assumption, yes. I mean, it was racist. I agree with you there. But the motive of it wasn't to establish racial dominance. It's not like Hitler with his notion of Aryan racial superiority, who set out to eliminate the people that he deemed to be inferior.
Okay. Well, again, I'm not specifically addressing motivations. I'm just looking at the end result that we have and have had for a long time now, white dominating non-white worldwide. I'm not particularly interested in picking apart exactly why they're doing this or anything else. Just it's here, it's incorrect, unjust, as you talked about in your book, and what we can do to work against that. I did want to point out, because, and you have photographs in the book as well that I think are very interesting, one of them being of a so-called Moorish woman in from Algeria, and you said that a crucial aspect of the colonial vision of the colonized was sexual, and in particular in the area of the world known as Algeria, the women were covered. You did not display yourself to everyone except to your family, husband, children, that type of thing. And this postcard showing a non-white female from Algeria, no top, face not covered, and you talked about how that was a crucial aspect of colonialism. What I'm saying is white supremacy, total domination of these people. We have them subjected in every manner. We control every aspect of their lives. Am I reading correctly what you said, and,
yeah,
and could you share that with us?
I agree with that. But you also have to bear in mind that that this effort at domination didn't succeed. It succeeded for a while, and then there was an Algerian nationalist revolt against the French control, and the Algerians achieved independence against the French, and have been running their own affairs since then. And one of the grievances that they had was exactly what you're talking about. In fact, the women who allowed themselves to be treated, I mean, this was a model who was posing. This isn't a scene from real life. This is a set-up picture.
Right.
There were a couple of photographers who sort of specialized in doing that, and they paid money to the models to pose in this very transgressive way, and the women were seen as sort of sexual collaborators with the enemy. So you have a bit of an echo in China when I talk about the China Bounder and the sexual nationalism that his blog post aroused. You had in Algeria and North Africa, earlier on, you had that same kind of resentment against the violation of the code of the sexual code of North Africa, the unveiling, the involuntary unveiling, which comes about, you know, as a result of colonial power.
I did want to get some callers, because folks have called in to see if they have some questions they would like to ask you, Mr. Bernstein.
Yeah. Would you give me one minute?
Sure.
Awkward, but I have my wife has been calling in on my cell phone, and I really am a little bit worried about checking to see whether
sure
what she needs to talk to me. But I could I come back in just 1 minute?
Yes, sir. Not a problem.
Okay. I'll be right back then.
Okie dokie. Again. Context of white supremacy. Justice Gus T. Renegade. Before I get to the callers, Justice, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Do you have some questions before we go to the phone lines that you would like to ask when Mr. Bernstein gets back with us?
No, I don't.
Okay. No problem. Thank you all for tuning in to the broadcast. I'll go ahead and check and see if 111. Person at 111, you called in. Do you have a question or comment you would like to ask Mr. Bernstein?
Hello, hello.
I can hear you kind of. Could you speak up a little bit?
Hello?
Okay, I can hear you.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay, I'm back. I apologize for that.
No problem, sir.
Make sure there was no emergency. There's nothing going on. So, anyway, let's go ahead.
Okie dokie. We had one person who called in. Did you have a question for Mr. Bernstein?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Excuse me.
Okay, I wanted to know how were the children of the whites and non-whites treated in these countries? How are they treated in these countries?
That's a very, very good question and a very important one because in many instances they were not treated well at all. There's a wide range of experience. There were men who had children with Indian or Japanese or Chinese women. They regarded them as their own children. They brought them to their own countries. They educated them or they cared for them all of their lives. But this was probably the exception. Many, many of these children were just abandoned by the men that fathered them, and they had a very hard time of it in the societies in which they grew up because they were seen to be the children of prostitutes, fatherless children, children of mixed race, and they went through life with a lot of disadvantages. And you still have today in Vietnam one of the elements of the the heritage of the American War in Vietnam are what they call the Amerasian children, mixed race children, children of either white fathers and Vietnamese mothers or black fathers and Vietnamese mothers, and these people who are now grown up have had a very hard time. They were discriminated against in Vietnam. They were not embraced by the Vietnamese people. They've lived on the margins of Vietnamese society all of their lives. And there are many, many tens and hundreds of thousands of children have been produced over the decades and centuries as a result of this.
What about during colonialism?
Well, the same sort of thing. In India, it was a little different. The French, especially in Southeast Asia, tended to be more accepting of relations between French and Vietnamese. There were a lot of French men, many more men than women, who married Vietnamese, who had families, led perfectly normal lives, whose children went to school and were cared for the way children should be. During back in the 19th century, this was the case in Vietnam. In India, there were what were called Anglo-Indians. These were the children of British fathers and Indian mothers. And again, there was a wide variety of results. Some of these children were well taken care of, well educated, but a lot of them were mistreated. A lot of them were discriminated against all their lives because they were the products of mixed marriages, and they didn't have fathers that took responsibility.
We have some more folks who called in. If you want to call in to ask a question, 347-215-6071. 253, do you have a question or comment? Are you there?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
I had a question for Mr. Bernstein. The illustrations in your book, for example, like Khoi Khoi San, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Cho Cho San, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cho Cho, okay.
The character in Madame Butterfly you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering, like, did any of the white men that did some of the exploitation, and this was an unfortunate incident where she had slit her throat because of he came back to get his child with his other wife when he said that he was going to come back to, I believe, Japan for her.
Right.
I'm wondering, did any of these people ever make any comments of remorse or any type of apology for what had happened to these Asian women?
I don't know about expressions of remorse or apology. There are certainly examples that I have a couple of them in the book of European men who went back to Japan, who recognized their children, who paid for their education, who did care that they had fathered children and were concerned about the welfare of these children, even though I don't know of many instances where they actually took the children back with them or stayed in Japan, married to the women. These were often men who were married to other wives back home, but at least they took some responsibility and they tried to do something for the women or the boys and girls that they fathered. And there's one instance of a German, and I have to take a look at my own book to remember the details of this, his daughter actually became one of the very first women to graduate from a Japanese medical school because he took an interest in her and, helped to, paid for her education and, it's just sort of generally at least somewhat responsible for what he had done. I think what's interesting about the whole Madame Butterfly story, though, is that it really does sort of take place in a real context. Here it's, to a great extent, it's the... it's Western men taking advantage of something that's already available in Asia. For centuries, Western men took advantage of the system of sexual hospitality in Japan. I found the chapter on Japan actually may be the one that I find most fascinating, to research and to write. I was absolutely amazed by what I found about the Japanese experience, going way back to the 17th century when the first European settlers went there. But around Nagasaki, which is where most of the Westerners were allowed to settle, it was very common for a man like the character in Madame Butterfly to be set up with a house. The same broker who found the house would also find him a temporary wife, and he would live with a temporary wife for a matter of months or a matter of a year or two. And then when his tour of duty was finished, he would go home, and the temporary wife would be left behind. And if there was a child involved, more often than not, the child would be, left behind with the mother. I mean, in a way, what's interesting about the Madame Butterfly story is that the American soldier, he goes back home, he marries an American woman, and the two of them come back to Japan in order to take possession of the child that the temporary wife has given birth to. That was what was a little bit unusual in the Madame Butterfly story. Might have departed a little bit from the actual historical experience.
Two, five, three. Did you have another question that you wanted to ask?
I do. I'm wondering, why is it that you don't talk to your wife about white supremacy?
well, I guess because I don't see our relationship as certainly having anything to do with it. She may not be a white person, but she's certainly very much an equal partner in our relationship. She doesn't see our relationship as an illustration of white supremacy. We just happen to be two people who met and like each other and got married and are happy together. I don't see my wife as a representative of some kind of a historical or national category, and she doesn't see me in that way either. I don't think she's just the person. She's the woman I love, and that I. And that I'm lucky enough to be married to, and I think that she sees me as the man that she married. I mean, we're not categories to each other.
Do you believe that she gets mistreated by other white people?
Well, I've never observed it, and I don't think that she feels that she's been mistreated by white people. And by the way, likewise, when we go to China, which we do almost every year for a few weeks, the people that we've encountered, we've traveled all over the country. We take trains and planes together. We stay in hotels together. We have a son, a mixed race son, who we travel with. I've never experienced the slightest discrimination or hostility or anything like that in China. I don't think that she has experienced that either. I mean, I don't know if we were to travel to, less tolerant parts of the world, in America, Ku Klux Klan territory, redneck territory, whether we would run into hostility. Or not. All I can say is we've traveled widely together, and we've been together now for almost 20 years, and we just haven't had bad experiences. Are you there? Hello?
I can hear you. I can hear you. It seems Mr. Bernstein might have dropped off. Hopefully he will call back in, and you can finish your question. I see someone also put their hand up. I will get you in a second. Hang tight. Hopefully Mr. Bernstein will bring us back. Again, I've never had this much interference in doing a program. I suspect white people are not pleased with this show. Oh, he called back. Here we go. We got you, Mr. Bernstein. Thank you for calling back in. I appreciate it, sir.
Sure.
253, if you want to finish up your question, he's back with us.
All right, Mr. Bernstein.
Yes.
I was just saying that's very interesting that you would say that you haven't been mistreated or haven't observed any type of mistreatment while traveling to other countries. My parents are both from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, they told me, like, I had asked if they wanted to go visit there. I've never visited there and would like to see where my parents have lived and whatnot. They actually recommended that I do not go back to Vietnam because of the security and because of the way I would be treated in Vietnam. However, that if I went with a white person, that I would be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Well, that's interesting. But you are of Vietnamese ancestry yourself. Your parents are from Vietnam, and they are Vietnamese, ethnically Vietnamese. You mean?
I suppose that would be what we would be classified as.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess listen. I don't know what it's like for somebody to visit Vietnam who's not in the company of a white person, but I certainly know that an awful lot of Vietnamese Americans do go. And I've been to Vietnam. I went to Vietnam three times while I was researching this book, and I was in Vietnam one time before on a journalistic trip. The last two times I was in Vietnam, the last one time I was in Vietnam, I was there with my wife. Again, no bad experiences. I've never heard anybody express the worry that your parents have for you. And far be it from me to say that they're wrong. They probably know a lot more about it than I do. But I certainly have met other Vietnamese people of Vietnamese ancestry who were visiting Vietnam, and I don't have the impression that they felt that the security problem was particularly bad. So, And there's certainly, you know, there are a lot of white. By the way, just as a matter of interest, this is off the subject, but because I was in the wrong place at the wrong time one night in Ho Chi Minh City, I fell into a bad group of men on motor scooters, and I was held up and robbed at knife point late at night. I was by myself. So, you know, I mean, I don't think that being a white person in Vietnam necessarily buys you total security either. But, you know, being mugged can happen any place in the world. It can happen in New York, too. It just happened. It happened that it happened to me in Vietnam because I, you know, because I didn't. You know, in New York, I'm a little savvier. I have, you know, where not to go late at night. I didn't know that in Saigon, and I got nailed. Hello?
Yes, I'm there.
Okay, but still, I was afraid that we might have gotten cut off again.
Not this time, thankfully. Someone called in at 111-253. You're still there if you want to get another question or comment in. Someone called in at 111 and put a hand up. 111, are you there?
Hotep victims.
Greetings, sir. How are you doing?
I don't know that I can be more intensely victimized.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that. Did you have a question that you wanted to ask our guest, Mr. Bernstein?
I do have a comment. I don't think I have any questions for your guest.
Okay.
My comment is this. My tally with your white guest is 100%. 100% that, in principle, they are for everything in terms of promoting justice and what is righteous. And they will never do anything in practice to bring about justice. Thank you, Mr. Bernstein.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for your comment.
Thank you, 702. Thank you. I did want a question. 253, you're still with us if you want to get a question in as well. I did want to, very interesting. I did read your book cover to cover, and in doing so, we started with Rudyard Kipling, and we ended with Joseph Conrad, who is another white person who I generally get no argument. People concede, yeah, that guy's a racist, Heart of Darkness, racist. Yeah, he's pretty much just explicitly talking about how white supremacy and dominating non-white people, heathen non-white people. And you ended your book talking about that and even making a comparison in some sense in saying some of these white people who go to these non-white areas and sexually exploit non-white people who are in a tough position. It's kind of reminiscent of what Mr. Conrad was talking about in Heart of Darkness, unless, you know, I misinterpreted your reading.
Well, I think you have a bit. It certainly wasn't my
question.
I don't. I mean, I do mention Conrad, but he doesn't figure very prominently.
It's in the last chapter.
Conrad in the last chapter?
Yeah, I can flip
really
to it. I have it.
Chapter called Judgments, and I talk about the debate over, you know, how should we feel morally about all of this, especially about the, you know, what goes on today in the realm of sex tourism and Western men who continue to go to Asia in search of sexual opportunities. Where I think, and I come across, I mean, the truth is that I personally found it hard to make judgments, or certainly sweeping judgments. I mean, on the one hand, there's no question, and I certainly describe it this way in the book, and I talk very, you know, explicitly about it in the book this way, as a, you know, it's a sleazy picture, and you know, I don't have particular, you know, admiration for men who go to Asia or live in Asia, you know, because they are, you know, interested in the opportunities that are there with Western women, or who, you know, sort of pack their suitcase full of condoms and head off to Thailand for a week or two of sex, you know, in the go-go bars or the massage parlors or what have you. And on the other hand, I'm not I'm a little bit unwilling to see it as a sort of naked exploitation. There are plenty of illustrations of naked exploitation. And by the way, I've been criticized in some reviews for this, but I haven't been persuaded by any of the arguments that I've seen in these reviews. By and large, with the exceptions of the men who go there for sex with children, and there are such men, but leaving them out of the picture for the moment, the men who are going to Thailand or the Philippines, or who live there and go to the go-go bars or the massage parlors, they are doing it with women who are of age and of women who are agreeing to do it. I mean, Thailand, I don't think, I mean, I interviewed Thai politicians about this. I interviewed people involved in social reform in Thailand. Nobody, I interviewed women who were very offended by the, Thai women who were very offended by the notion of sex tourism. But I didn't meet anybody who said these women are slaves, that they're forced to do what they're doing. Most of them come from an area of Thailand called the Isan. It's the three provinces in the northeast that are the poorest in the region. And they are going down to Bangkok because they can make 20 times as much money in a couple of years working the bars or massage parlors in Bangkok than they could make, working back home. They're also, it's not as though the alternative for these women is to lead, kind of upper crust, to be soccer moms from Shaker Heights or something like that. The alternative for these women is usually pretty grim. It isn't as though these white men, looking for sex in Southeast Asia are tearing these women away from some kind of wonderful life and forcing them to demean themselves sexually and therefore exploiting them. There's a certain degree of mutuality in the exploitation. And
hold on a second. That just mutuality in the exploitation. I just want everybody to think about it. I just want our listeners to think. Now, does that make logical sense given what you've heard on this program? Mutuality of the exploitation, where you've already conceded a lot of these non-white females are in a very tough predicament. I just want everybody listening, think. Now, does that make sense to me?
Well,
and I did want to point out, because we had a couple.
Let me explain what I mean by that.
Okay. We had two callers, too, so if you could.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's take the call then. Let's take the calls, and maybe we'll get back to it.
Okay. I'll make sure you get time to finish your point, sir. 831. 831,
hello?
Are you with us? I can hear you.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Hi. This is Throna Vasset. I wanted to ask him, did he hear about the announcement that I think Francois Mitterrand made about sleeping with young boys in France? And do you think this is indicative of the people who are in power across the board, including America, that there is an undercover pedophilia going on? Because I've heard the same thing about the American government, that there's actually young boys who are sent into the White House for pedophilic purposes. Did you know anything about this?
We did talk about Mitterrand. It wasn't Francois Mitterrand. It's a nephew of Francois Mitterrand who wrote in a memoir in 2005 that he paid to have sex with boys in Southeast Asia, and that's a bit of a scandal now going on in France. We did talk about that earlier, ma'am, and you must have missed that part of the program. The other part of it, no, I've never heard of any such thing, and I mean, it sounds to me like that's kind of sort of fringe theory, a conspiracy theory. There's no evidence, and there's no, I mean, I just don't have any reason to believe that. I don't have any facts either. I'm not privy to who goes into the White House and what the sexual lives of government officials is. I certainly know that we have plenty of sex scandals. I mean, plenty of misbehavior ends up getting exposed in the press, and if, young boys were being smuggled into the White House for pederastic purposes, somehow I think that it would become known.
Okay.
So I'm very skeptical of that, and unless I have some real evidence, I don't see any reason to believe it.
Okay. 253, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I had another one. Mr. Bernstein, did you ever participate while you were in Asia in any prostitution or sexual exploitation or sex with Asian women, period?
Sex with Asian women, yes. I mean, I lived in Asia for 7 years, and I had a couple of girlfriends during that time. I didn't meet my wife until quite a lot later when I came home from Asia. We actually met, even though she's Chinese, we met in New York. So yeah, I mean, I've had sentimental experiences of my own in Asia, yes. And during the research for the book, I didn't engage myself, but I visited a couple of go-go bars, and I interviewed some prostitutes, and I interviewed the manager of one of the go-go bars, and I interviewed certainly a number of Western men who live in Bangkok who are there in order to take advantage of the opportunities that are there. So I think I'm fairly familiar with the scene, but I don't think you have to have been a participant in it in order to be familiar with it.
So you're saying you've never paid for sex?
Well, I mean, have you?
No.
Yeah, okay, well, I've answered the question as fully as I intend to.
I see.
Okay. I did want to make sure I gave you an opportunity. I wanted to give you a chance to finish up your statement before we wrap up. But I did have the passage where you were speaking about the heart of darkness, and you said, I felt a power of repulsion for the man, for his being unwilling to grow old with more dignity, for his being an old lecher who clearly had bought the companionship of his Filipino girlfriend, setting himself up like a sort of Mr. Kurtz in Conrad's Heart of Darkness, subjecting
right.
his
you
attendant.
Know, but don't forget, Gus, first of all, Kurtz.
Well, wait a minute, because you said that you thought I was misinterpreting you, and this sounds exactly like what I said, that you were comparing some of these white people who go and sexually exploit the non-white females to exactly what a explicit white supremacist talked about in his book. Now, if I'm incorrect, let me know, but that sounds exactly like what I'm saying.
Well, but you're taking it out of context, and you know, listen, I don't take back a word that I have in the book. As far as Conrad himself, I mean, it was a very quick reference to Conrad's Mr. Kurtz in Heart of Darkness. Mr. Kurtz is an extremely negative character in Conrad. He's not somebody that Conrad admired. He was a man who was, the whole point of Heart of Darkness is that Conrad was exposing the arrogance and the kind of Mephistophelian character of this guy Kurtz, who exploited and misused the power that he had in the colonial situation in Africa. So I don't think that Heart of Darkness illustrates Conrad himself as a white supremacist. I think it illustrates him as a critic of white supremacy. And as far as the guy that I'm talking about a guy that I saw in the Philippines years ago. It's at the beginning of this chapter called Judgments, who I see with a young Filipino woman. And yes, my first reaction was one of revulsion, and to think of him as Kurtz, a guy who was exploiting his power maliciously in a sort of ugly way. That was my first reaction. And then as I thought about it a little bit more, I thought about it in a little bit more nuanced way, and I used that to sort of show how difficult, in fact, it is for me to really, I don't approve, but I also don't condemn these men. It all depends on what the attitude of the woman that he was with was. And I allow for the possibility that she might have, that it might have been the best that she could make of a bad bargain in life. I doubt very much that she was in love with the man, or that he represented some kind of a romantic ideal for her. But in taking care of him and in accompanying him, she was being paid. Maybe she was sending her younger sister and brother to school. Maybe she advertised herself in one of these magazines that used to be published in those days. You can get them online now. There are thousands and thousands of Asian women who are advertising themselves to have a relationship with a Western man. They want it. They're volunteering for it. It's sad. I mean, it's extremely sad that women are in the position of having to do that. But when the man answers the ad and says, "Yes, okay, I'll enter into this financial bargain with you. I will buy the charm of your company in my closing years, and I will solve your economic problems and the economic problems of your family." It's a harsh bargain in an ugly world. I fully recognize that, but I'm not quite ready to condemn the man who strikes that bargain with a woman. That was making in that chapter, in that passage.
Okay, and I also want to make sure, because I think this is very important, not only are you writing from the perspective of a white man, and what I'm saying is the system of white supremacy, you're also writing from the perspective of a white man who is married to an Asian female. How much of an impact do you think that has on how you view these relationships?
It has. I suppose it might have some impact, but I think that I have. I think I have the ability to see past my own personal experience and to recognize that, you know, that my experience is a very individual one. I don't know really what it illustrates. I think that my interest in the topic came because I lived in Asia, because I saw this attraction. I saw that for Western men living in Asia, to have an Asian girlfriend was part of the adventure. And I think it continues to be part of the adventure. And so it was, you know, my personal observation, and to some extent my personal experience. The other caller wanted to know whether I'd ever paid for sex. I just think that's irrelevant, and I didn't want to answer that question. If I say no, she'll think I'm lying. And if I say yes, it's not relevant. It's not important whether I did or not. So I didn't want to answer, sort of like, you know, have you stopped beating your wife yet? That kind of question. I didn't want to answer it. But my own personal experience is, you know, yes, it informs the topic to some extent. It makes me interested in it, but it doesn't govern everything that I think and feel about it.
Do you think someone could read this book and, knowing, because you do mention it in the book that you're married to an Asian female, that someone could read this book, and particularly when they read the last chapter, and you summarized it briefly for us, where you talk about in the last chapter, judgment, that you don't want to judge the white people who do this. You don't want to judge them as being, you know, monsters who are just going over here and exploiting these poor Asian females or wherever they happen to be in the world. And you also don't want to judge the non-white females who are doing this, like, oh my gosh, don't you have more respect for yourself? I can't believe you would do this sort of thing. And not, you know, want to judge either one of these people. Do you think a non-white person could read this and say, hey, I think this, the author, a white male, married to an Asian female, doesn't want to be harsh in judging this because it might be self-incriminating. I can't really look at this too hard because I might have to have some serious thoughts about what I'm doing being in a sexual relationship with an Asian female.
Well, there was one blog post that said that, there were other people have made that argument. One woman who, first of all, said that she didn't read the book and wasn't going to read the book, but nonetheless she then wrote 2,000 words condemning the book that she admitted she hadn't read. This is a white woman, by the way, said that the book was a sweaty, pseudo-academic justification for my own Asian babes fetish. So, you know, put in very rude terms, that, you know, this point has been made. But on the overall point of, you know, how to feel about it, my relationship with my wife is a just a normal relationship between a man and a woman. I mean, the fact that she happens to be Chinese, just, you know, we've been together for 20 years. I don't look at her and say, oh, she's Chinese. I look at her and say, that's my wife. She's a person with individual characteristics. Our relationship on a daily basis just doesn't, none of that stuff plays out. And I can understand how, you know, the appearance of it, but it really is pretty irrelevant. It enters into the picture in the ways that I've said, and if it entered into the picture in a bigger way, I wouldn't conceal it either. I'm not ashamed of anything. I'm certainly not embarrassed about having a Chinese wife. And I don't think there's anything, I think it's fine. You know, you marry whoever you fall in love with. And if she happens to be the same race, then fine. If she's a different race, that's fine too. I don't make any, if it's an individual personal decision, I wouldn't make it my business to judge anybody on those grounds about who they choose to be their partners in life. And I don't want anybody drawing any conclusions about me in that regard either. I mean, on the overall question of judgment, I mentioned earlier that you didn't like the expression. You thought that it was kind of silly, mutual exploitation. I can see why you would think that that's kind of silly, because on the, you know, at the beginning of it, you know, you see, oh, these guys are coming with money and they're buying the sexual services of these women, and so they're exploiting them. Again, what is exploitation? Slaves were certainly exploited. You know, they were made to work without compensation and against their will, because they were deemed to be put on the planet to serve that purpose. This is an idea that thankfully has no longer holds sway, but I suppose there are still some people around who believe it. But certainly, we can all agree that that's exploitation. A person who pays pays very, very low survival wages and gets rich on that is also, I would say, exploiting somebody. But when you go to a place and a woman offers herself to you and she's going to make more money from what you and other customers pay her than she could ever dream of by doing anything else. And she's able to use that money to build herself a nice big house back in her hometown and to build a house for her mother and father, to send money to her for her younger brothers and sisters to be educated. Is that exploitation? I don't know. I mean, it's sad and kind of sleazy. I understand that. But is it exploitation? I don't see it that way. And that's why I talk about, you know, there are plenty of men. I mean, it's funny. You read the book very carefully, so you remember the interview that I did with the manager of this go-go bar called Angel Witch, whom I interviewed. And he talked about how so many of these Western men, they're kind of lonely. I mean, you know, men who have happy family lives back home are not going off to Thailand for weeks of sex tourism. These are usually kind of lonely guys, a little sad. They're not married. They have trouble, you know, finding female companionship. And so they go off to Asia where it's, you know, where they can just buy it, where it's very easy. And they kind of fall in love with these girls. They want these girls to love them back. They want them to appreciate them for their manly virtues. And, of course, the women don't. I mean, for them, this is just a business relationship. And there are men who, the bar manager told me, there are men who send monthly stipends to these women as an effort to win their favor. And you see them in the internet cafes on this, you know, in Bangkok sending, you know, messages to three or four different men in different places of the world saying, I miss you, and I love you, and I can't wait for you to come back to Bangkok. It's to keep the money coming in. There is a certain mutuality in that sense. These women actually, it might seem strange to you, but they exercise a certain power over their customers in that regard. And they're getting what they want from them. They're getting money. The men are interested in sex. The women are interested in money. They're both getting what they want. Is that exploitation? And do you think that these women, if they were staying back in their villages in the Northeast, They would be giving it away for nothing to some, you know, local guy who visited the local whorehouse, because the local whorehouse is a big part of the picture in villages in Thailand, and who would be beating her and mistreating her and wouldn't be taking care of her, wouldn't be respecting her. It's not like, you know, they're being, as I said before, they're being torn away from some kind of ideal life. They're doing it because they think it's the best option that they have available to them. And the way to end it would be to eliminate rural poverty. And some of the people that I interviewed in Thailand, I mean, one guy in particular who's, I think he ought to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, he's a great guy who has done more in the area of economic development in Thai rural areas than any other person that I know of. Who's, you know, he says, look at, okay, you know, just said more or less what I just said. You know, is it okay? It's a kind of foreign aid. Would it be better to give military aid? Would it be better to be selling, you know, giving us weapons like the American government does? Would it be better to, you know, to be giving you know, government hands out that you know ends up lining the pockets of corrupt bureaucrats anyway? At least this is money that's going into the hands of the people who can use it. And he doesn't condemn it either, you know, a Thai social reformer. So I don't, you know, I just don't think that the picture is all that simple and easy. And that's why I don't. It's easy to preach, you know, easy to preach morality to other people. But you know, the real world is what it is, and people have to do what they have to do in order to survive in it.
Okay. I wanted to check before we wrap things up. 253, did you have a final comment or question for Mr. Bernstein?
Not this time, thank you.
Okie dokie. As I said, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I learned a lot that I just was ignorant about before. I learned a lot. Book, The East, the West, and Sex. Again, wanted to point out page 12 of the book, Mr. Bernstein, there would appear to be a complicated mixture of image and experience at play here. But almost everything in this picture relates to the experience of colonial power. I just scratch out colonial power and put in the system of white supremacy. I could be incorrect. Hopefully, if you listen to the program, you can hear what was said and come to your own conclusions. Definitely want to thank Mr. Bernstein. Thank you for taking time out of your Saturday afternoon to hang out with us here on the Cows. Learned a lot from the book and learned a lot from having you on the program. Thank you so much, sir.
Well, thank you. I very much appreciate your having me. It was very enjoyable and fascinating for me, too.
For sure. He also, Mr. Bernstein, also wrote Ultimate Journey, and he continues to write a column, unless I'm incorrect, for the International Herald Tribune. Is that correct?
You are correct.
Okay. We will definitely look out for the column. And The East, the West, and Sex. Very interesting read. Think you'll learn a lot. Mr. Richard Bernstein, thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye now.
All right. Cows, interesting program. I hope everyone who listens to this program keeps in mind he is married to an Asian female. We had a couple people who were still on the line. If you have questions or comments before we wrap up, if you'd like to say anything, please go ahead. Any of the folks hanging out? Question or comment before we wrap things up?
Oh, I am still here, victim.
Yes, sir, I can hear you.
Whew, that was a doozy. I need to go recover.
Very informed white person. That's about exactly what I expected. I thought he was going to be very informed, and particularly the fact that he's married to an Asian female, I suspected he was going to be, I got exactly what I expected. Exactly what I expected.
Whew, yeah, I was, And I wish that your co-host would have had more questions, but she is a wise one.
she had said beforehand she was going to hang out for about the first hour or so. She had some other things to do, but yeah, I would have been interested in hearing how she would have responded to some of his questions. I think that would have been... Oh, she's still here. How about that? I thought you were not going to be here. You're still here, Justice. Did you? Were you able to hear Mr. Bernstein?
Yes.
Okay. What did you think about what he had to say?
I wasn't listening the whole entire time.
Yeah, that's... See, okay, I wasn't incorrect. That's what I thought. Yeah, he was... I'm sorry?
I did have a question because I missed some of the show. Did he ever say exactly why he took such an interest in writing the book?
At the very beginning, he said that he's been a journalist for a long time. He worked for Time Magazine and the New York Times. And he said that he spent a lot of time. He said he's been to all of the so-called Asian countries, and he saw tons of white people there in sexual relationships with Asian females, and that it fascinated him. It seemed like something of interest. He talked to his publishers, and they said, yeah, we think this would be interesting. You should go ahead and do a book on it. I suspect the fact that he's married to an Asian female probably motivated him to do this research at some level, perhaps. But basically, he said, yeah, he had been in all these Asian countries and was seeing so many white people there in sexual relationships with Asian females, so he decided to further explore.
I see. Oh, man, did he agree with your definition of white supremacy?
He said that he felt it was true, that there's a lot of historical evidence to support white people have dominated non-white people, but he thinks right now things have changed. We have a so-called, his term was multiracial, multi-ethnic society here in this area of the world, and China is coming up and doing big things. So he didn't think that was as applicable now. He felt that what we have now is a legacy of Western domination. I believe that was the term that he used.
That was very confusing.
Yeah, I told him I felt my definition was more accurate. In his book, he uses the terms West and East predominantly. He generally does not reference the white people who are going and doing these acts as white people. They generally just get referenced as Westerners, colonists. Those are the terms he generally uses to reference white people, but he, on the program, he was much more explicit in saying white people.
And I just want to be direct and as honest as I can. I do suspect that he was a master of deception.
I am certain. Just as I said, him not using correct words, I don't think legacy of Western domination is the most correct term. He said mutually exploitive. You all can listen and make your own decision if you think that makes sense for what we were talking about in this particular situation. And again, you know, in his book, he says if this were the other way around, non-white people were going to white areas doing this, I don't think white people would have the same view of what's going on. I think they would have a very different view if you had a lot of non-white people from so-called Zimbabwe or Ethiopia plopping down in Wisconsin and shacking up with, you know, 15-year-old white women. I think white people would have a very different view on this, but I could be wrong.
You know, and one last comment. I know one last comment. I do find it extremely curious how once you point out to your white guest that they've said something completely opposite of what they say, that may seem as though they're saying there is no white supremacy. And then once you point out they say something that says there is, it's just curious to me what is going on in their minds, because I say, well, they've obviously done quite a bit of research, and do they just have a total amnesia? It's a very curious thing, a very confusing thing.
I have noted that as well. I think some of the other non-white people who've called the program have noted a very similar trend where white people will come on the program and say one thing, and then when they're reminded of something that they said in their literature and it presents a contradiction, then, you know, they're left to explain this. I can only attribute it to racism, white supremacy. Number one, I suspect that a lot of these white people probably are not writing their book thinking that non-white people are going to be reading their work, and I definitely think that a lot of these white people have no thought that non-white people who are focused on replacing white supremacy with justice are going to be reading their books and pruning them to see if it makes sense with, you know, what they know about the system of white supremacy. So I think that's a major part of it. And I also think, and I've had white people tell me that white people are trained to be confusing and deceptive when they talk to non-white people about racism, white supremacy. So I think it's probably a little bit of both. Them just talking to non-white people and not being clear. I think white people have even come on this program and said that. I believe Jessica Pettit said it the first time she was here. That's something that white people do to practice racism, not speak clearly about the system of white supremacy. And then their books, I don't think they're written for non-white people. So I think that's a part of it. But, yeah. And I also, for some reason, I suspect a lot of these people are accustomed to doing interviews with people who have not read their book entirely. I have gotten that impression the more these shows have gone along. I know John Patash, who was on last weekend, he said he would send me a book, but he said, you gotta promise me that you're going to read the whole thing. And I almost wanted to tell him, do you know who I am? I have a reputation here to uphold. I'm not going to bring a white person on this show and not read their book, because I've just seen too many times where they have been contradictory to things that they've written in their book. And a lot of times these white people have a lot of, you know, helpful information in their work. Mr. Bernstein, a lot of good information in this book that I didn't know anything about before I read it. And I can say that for pretty much every white person I've had on the show. So I think they might be accustomed to doing shows where people haven't read their book, so they can just kind of say whatever they want, and people don't really challenge them because they haven't read the book. But, yeah, I have observed the same thing. It is very interesting. I plan to stay on my toes and continue to read the work of anybody that comes on the show so that, yeah, we can continue to see if this happens. People come here and deviating from what they wrote in their work.
And I must say I'm so grateful and extremely thankful for the excellent, excellent job you do in exposing them. Not just for myself, but for all of us who are confused. We need it.
I am confused as well. I am thankful. If you find it constructive, worthy of your time and energy, share it with other non-white people. We need more. We need more help. I'm still confused, and we need to get better. Yeah. Again, Justice, she would have talked more today, but she had said she was going to be kind of in and out of the program. She's out doing things today, so hopefully we'll have her back hanging out doing her thing when we get back. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the broadcast. I appreciate the support. We'll be back tomorrow. We have Mark Riding. He'll be on the program at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central, 1 p.m. Pacific. Mark Riding, he was just in Newsweek. They had an article with a white infant on the front. It was about racism. Had an article on him. Mr. Riding, he is a black male. He adopted a white female child. Just very interesting. You can, if you look at this description for tomorrow's program, you'll see a link where you can read the article from Newsweek that talked about him. He's also been on NPR. You can see the link for when he was on NPR. You can click that and check out what he had to say. But he'll be here tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Yaffa Bey, she will also be here tomorrow. All about words. She does a lot of important work about how to use a dictionary correctly, the importance of knowing what words mean, getting the definitions of words when people talk to you, and how people can use words to be deceptive, and particularly manipulating what words mean so that they can mistreat you when they talk to you. I think that's very important. Non-white people need that. That would help us a lot, I think, in working against racism. But she'll be here tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. Please check my blog, Racism white-notes.blogspot.com. Check Back of the Buses blog as well, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you all for listening to the program. If anybody's there, if you have a final thought before we sign off, go right ahead.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. This is totally off subject, but when an enforcement official pulls you over, like, or when they radar you, I'm sorry, I'm being pulled over by an enforcement official right now.
Oh, my
gosh. If they radar you or, you know, whatever, don't they have to be sitting still to catch you, catch your speed, or can they be driving? Does anyone know?
I have seen enforcement officials who are in motion use radar detector to gauge speed. I think they might have the technology where they can be in motion and still use radar to detect your speed.
I see. Okay. I was unaware. I thought that they had to be sitting still. So anyhow, great. Thanks for answering that question.
That's awful. Yeah. We're going to do a show on that, so hopefully we'll get better information on what to do when you are stopped by enforcement officials. That's coming down the road next month. We'll have a white former chief of police in Seattle, Washington, to talk about what you can do to minimize your victimization when you have contact with police officials. So I'll make sure to ask him about that, but I think, yeah, they can be in motion and do it, but I'll make sure to ask him to get clarification on that. Excellent questions. People in the chat room said you were all-star today with your questions. This is 253 Kim, I believe. Excellent questions. They appreciated you going at Mr. Bernstein and asking him tough questions. I did as well. Excellent job, ma'am.
Thank you.
Indeed.
Very interesting show.
Thank you for calling in. I appreciate the support. 720, did you have anything else?
Oh, I was agreeing with you. Her questions were excellent.
Oh, gotcha. That's going to call it a day then, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the program. Justice and Gus T. Renegade, we will be back. Hopefully the enforcement official will let my pal at 253 go so she can continue with her Saturday. I hope everybody out is having a constructive day. We will be back to hopefully provide information to replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Gus T. Renegade and Justice signing off. Thank you.